Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm going to cover Leviticus chapter 1 as we begin the study of the book of Leviticus. We're going to do verses 1 through 17, the entire chapter. Our context is this. In the last chapter of Exodus, we see that the tabernacle was erected. Now, before we start Leviticus, I'm going to give a pretty thorough introduction to this book. The book is not the easiest book in the world. It's got a lot of complicated stuff in it. So let's try to see the forest before we get into the trees. First of all, who was the author? Of course, the author was Moses. He authored the Pentateuch. I'm going to read a lot of scripture saying that Leviticus was written by Moses, because there's a lot of people out there, liberals, who say that Moses didn't write the Pentateuch, which he did. Exodus 17:14, then the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial. Exodus 24:4, Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Exodus 34:27, then the Lord said to Moses, write down these words. Joshua 8:31, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded the sons of Israel, as it is written in the book of the law of Moses. Mark 7:10, for Moses said, honor your father and your mother. Mark 12:26, but regarding the fact that the dead rise again, have you not read in the book of Moses? In the passage about the burning bush, how God spoke to him, saying, I'm the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. That's referring to Exodus 3:6, which is in the book of Moses, as Mark says. Luke 2:22-23, and when the days for their purification according to the law of Moses were completed, etc., etc., etc. Leviticus 27:34, these are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the sons of Israel. The NIV Study Bible says that that verse there is a strong evidence for Moses' authorship. It's not only strong, folks, it's conclusive. Unless you're a liberal, in which case you would doubt that 2 plus 2 equals 4. Romans 10:5, for Moses writes that the man who practices the righteousness which is based on law shall live by that righteousness. All right, so we've established that Moses wrote the book. I said that modern critical scholarship denies Moses' authorship, of course. Why they're wrong? Here's some reasons they're wrong. They ignore that in over 50 places in Leviticus, it says that God spoke to Moses, as I finished saying. I quoted you some of them. The liberals, the critical leftists, ignore the repeated claims of Leviticus to be Mosaic. Again, that's just what I read, why I read you all those verses. Another interesting fact is there are a lot of second millennium BC terms that are in the book. That's a scholarly statement that I can't back up because I'm not a scholar. But I present it to you in case you hear that Moses didn't write the book. Well, how do you explain these terms? Be something good to research as some of those, what those terms are. Second millennium BC terms, not first millennium BC. Now, here's the chronology. The traditional date, which is the date I'm going to use, is circa 1446. That would be the date of the Exodus. Now, where does that come from? We read in 1 Kings 6:1, that came about in the 480th year after the sons of Israel came out of the land of Egypt. In other words, 480 years after the Exodus, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is in the second month that he began to build the house of the Lord. In the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel. Well, the fourth year of Solomon's reign was 966. How do we know that? Because Solomon's reign dates are from 970 to 931. How do I know that? Wikipedia. And if it's in Wikipedia, you know it's got to be true. So 970, fourth year, that puts us up to 966 BC. Now, 966 BC is when they started building that temple. Solomon started building his temple, and that was said to be 480 years after the Exodus. So you take 966 BC, you add 480 years to that to go further back in time, and you end up at 1446 BC. That, folks, is when the Exodus took place. Unless you believe in the alternate date, which is 1290 BC, and it's very complicated. I don't even bother to go into the trouble to figure it out. My NIV Study Bible derives it for me, but I just punt it. I don't care. The NIV Study Bible says, quote, there are no compelling reasons to modify in any substantial way the traditional 1446 BC, 1446 BC date. I agree. So we're going to go with 1446 BC. The title Leviticus comes from the Septuagint, the Greek translation, and it means relating to the Levites. The book covers the laws given at Mount Sinai. The tabernacle's finished, so now we're going to look at all the sacrificial laws, basically, in Leviticus. Exodus took care of some history of the Israelites in Egypt, and then the Exodus, the history of that, and then the events at Mount Sinai, and then all the specs for the building of the tabernacle and setting up the tabernacle. We finished with that. So now in Leviticus, we're going to look at the laws having to do with the sacrifices. When we get to Numbers in the next book, we'll continue the history of the Israelites as they wander around the desert on their way to the Promised Land. Now, I'm going to give you a lot of introduction material from a man named Joe Sprinkle, whom I found on the internet. He has an excellent summary of Leviticus. So let's look at some possible rationales for the clean, unclean distinction that we find in the book. First of all, the purpose could be hygiene. Some laws promoted hygiene. For example, gonorrhea or leprosy victims were excluded from the camp, which of course would make the camp safer. You don't eat dead carcasses? Well, that's going to stop some disease. But now, cutting against that is that some of the prohibited animals in Leviticus had no association with any disease. For example, camels, wild boars, you could eat those without trouble. Wild boars don't have trichinosis. And anyway, if you cook a pig right, it's going to keep trichinosis from spreading to humans anyway. So you can't say that's got anything to do with health. Pork was a staple of Israel's neighbors, so people did know how to eat pork safely back then. You often hear people say, well, you know, the reason they didn't have pork is because they didn't have refrigerators. I confess I've said that before, too. I hereby take it back. A quick answer to that false assertion is Jesus declared everybody in the time of Jesus to be free from the law, so Jesus' contemporaries could eat pork, and they didn't have refrigerators, but it was okay to eat pork. And on the flip side of that, not only were some Levitically unclean animals perfectly safe to eat, but there were some Levitically clean animals that were health hazards. Number of parasitic animals in the law which would not be good to eat. They were considered clean according to the Levitical law, but not clean according to health. And many harmful things could have been included in the law, but were not. For example, poisonous plants. So we can't say that hygiene is the complete reason for the clean-unclean distinction, although some of the laws might have had a side effect of making Israel more hygienic. Second possibility of the distinction between clean and unclean foods, to avoid association with naturally disgusting things. For example, snakes were considered unclean. That might go back to the curse in the garden. I don't know. I know people. I just talked to a young 12-year-old girl at my church yesterday who showed me a picture for her snake called Jace. The ugliest, nastiest looking thing I ever saw. It was very long, ugly, just like all snakes look. But you know, some people just love those snakes. So I'm not sure this is a reason for the clean unclean distinction in Leviticus, that we want to stay away from naturally disgusting animals like slimy animals, creepy animals, rats, and of course wild dogs. They were wild back then, not pets, and they were unclean too. I guess that the law would keep Israel from sacrificing or eating disgusting animals because holiness is hard to associate with disgusting animals. And again, we've got to realize that disgusting is sort of a cultural thing too. I mean, I talked to a guy, I can tell you his name right now, who told me about how he ate rats, and he said it was very good and it tasted like chicken, and I'm about to throw up. And I said, well, how do you handle the disease? He said, what disease? You boil them in the pot so there is no disease. Well, he was poor growing up in China. They'd eat anything. And so he had no trouble with eating rats. He didn't think it was disgusting. And dogs, oh my gosh, I remember the first time Shenzhen in southern China, in Guangzhou province, Shenzhen, standing in front of a restaurant, and there I could read just enough Chinese to where it said, dog meat. They were advertising like, come in here and eat our dogs. And they ate dogs everywhere in southern China. So again, it's cultural. So I'm not sure that the law, the clean, unclean distinction in the Leviticus was to avoid the association with naturally disgusting things. And to further my point, there were lots of unclean animals that aren't disgusting, like rabbits. We eat rabbits today, but they were forbidden in the law, and they're not disgusting. We love rabbits, you know, the Easter Bunny and all that. Third possible reason for the clean, unclean distinction in the book of Leviticus, to avoid association with pagan religious practices. And I believe there is a lot of truth to this. The famous example is, you shall not cook a kid in his mother's milk. Now, that's not in Leviticus, that's somewhere else in the law, but it illustrates the point, because it's hard to find a reason why you don't want to cook a kid in his mother's milk. Now, some people say, well, it's to show love of animals and all that kind of stuff. Well, I don't think so. I suspect that some pagan somewhere was doing that kind of thing. In fact, I read somewhere that what the pagans would do is they would cook the kid in his mother's milk, and that would make a broth, and then they would sprinkle the broth over their plants to make them grow better, on the idea that the mother is prosperous. She's giving milk to her child, and so we'll make a broth out of it and sprinkle things to make things grow better. Okay. Well, we don't know because we weren't back then. We lose that. So you read a few weird things like that. Well, it's probably association with pagan religious practices. How about the poor pig that's declared unclean? Well, I've eaten enough pork in my life to know the pig meat's about the best meat that ever been made, except for steak, I guess. Oh, pork chops. Oh, my gosh. Bacon. Oh, sausage. Oh, my gosh, that's good. But back then, pigs were used to sacrifice to demons and underworld deities. This is the Hittites, the Egyptians, the Mesopotamians did that. So God didn't want, so this theory goes, God didn't want the Israelites to associate with pagan idolatry. So he says, no pigs for you to eat. Well, here's an argument against that. What about bulls? They were often used in pagan sacrifices, and bulls weren't condemned by Levitical law. You could eat a bull, a cow, a bull. So that can't be the entire reason. It might be a partial reason for a law here and there, but that can't be the main reason why of the main reason for the clean and unclean distinction in Leviticus. So here's a fourth possibility of why Leviticus makes this clean, unclean distinction: to make ethical lessons. Here's some examples of ethical lessons that are inculcated by the law in Leviticus. Number one, self-control, which is an indispensable first step in the attainment of holiness. For example, you are not to eat certain foods. You are to abstain from sex during the wife's menstruation. Well, there's nothing wrong with eating food, nothing wrong with having sex with your wife, but if you hold back, well, that shows self-control. Another ethical example of the Levitical law: eating dead animals reduces Israelites to the level of a scavenger dog, a wild dog which is destructive and murderous, and we're not going to do that. Here's another possible ethical lesson that we can get from Leviticus. It's a savage act to cook a kid in his mother's milk. Actually, that's not exactly in Leviticus. That's somewhere else, but it's in the law. And the idea here is that which it to give life to the kid, and we should want to give life to a kid before when he's getting ready to grow up, and instead we give it death. We kill it. So that's savagery. We want to be civilized. Fourth possible ethical lesson is that we might learn from Leviticus: respect to animal life. Not to eat flesh of the animal with blood in it. Just, I don't know how. I guess that somehow shows that you respect the animal because you're not eating his flesh with blood in it. I don't know about that. I think the reason for that is because life is in the blood, and we want to keep blood separate because it symbolizes the life that's laid out on the altar, and our life transferred to the altar and then transferred up to God as he takes that life for our sin. So I think blood has to be kept separate. I don't think it's to show respect to animal life. But some people say, well, that's in addition to the sacrificial use of blood. It also has the ethical idea of we need to respect that animal. Because if you respect the blood of an animal a fortiori, you're going to give respect to a human life. And there was no recreational killing of animals. You could just go out and shoot a deer, for example, and leave it out there and leave it its flesh to rot. I mean, hunters today don't even do that. They kill the deer and take it home and skin it and eat it, make venison out of it. Arguing against this idea that the law shows respect for animals, designating certain species as unclean, abhorrent, or abominable seems an odd way to inculcate respect for human life. It just seems a little weird. Here's the fifth possible reason for the clean and unclean distinction in Leviticus: to associate Yahweh with life and dissociate him from death. Here's an example of unclean things that are associated with death mentioned in Leviticus: corpses, animal carcasses, blood, predator animals. Most, not all, but most unclean animals were associated with death. Discharged semen. Sperm will die and not give life to an egg, so discharged semen is representative of death. Postpartum blood. That's associated with a womb that cannot give life, at least not at the present, as the blood comes out after a birth. I've already mentioned cooking a kid in his mother's milk. That's death to the kid, although that's not in Leviticus. Physical imperfections in both priests and the sacrifices. An imperfection means the body is closer to death. All right, so a lot of forbidden things in the law were associated with death, and a lot of clean things were associated to life. For example, the water of purification. Water is a standard symbol of life and purity, cleanliness. Now, what's the result of Leviticus disassociating Yahweh from death? Well, you're not going to do any pagan religious practices, some of them. For example, necromancy, which is a method of divination through alleged communication with the dead. You're not going to do that because you don't mess with the dead. Spiritualism, ancestor veneration, that kind of stuff is talking about speaking to the dead. And we're not going to speak with the dead. In other words, death hasn't got anything to do with God because God is life. Okay, well, that's possible one aspect of following the Levitical law is to understand life as opposed to death. Here's the sixth possible reason that Leviticus separates the clean from the unclean, to separate holiness from sexuality. Much pagan worship was involved in ritual prostitution, but in Leviticus, all expressions of sexuality rendered a person unclean. For example, priests had to wear underwear to hide their private parts. Exodus 28:42. This is not in Leviticus. This is in Exodus, but it's the same point. You shall make for them linen breeches to cover their bare flesh, their private parts. They shall reach from the loins even to the thighs. We're not going to let somebody, a priest's sexual organs be shown anywhere. And having sex rendered a person unclean in Leviticus. I don't have the site right here. Sprinkle, Mr. Sprinkle mentions that. We'll get to it eventually. Therefore, it was impossible to do sex and sacrifice at the same time. Well, again, that makes it sound like sex is unholy, which it's not. But sex is for this life. It's like eating. Nothing wrong with eating, nothing wrong with sex. But, you know, a lot of times people fasted when they did sacrifices. And they abstained from sex when they did sacrifices because they wanted to devote their attentions on God. It's hard to think about God when you're thinking about a steak or your wife. Seventh possibility of the reason that Leviticus separates the clean and the unclean is to separate the Israelites from the Gentiles, because the Gentiles were considered unclean. Now, there were three categories in the clean-unclean system. There was animals, there was people, and there was places. Let's look at animals first. Certain animals were clean. They could be sacrificed. There were certain clean, non-sacrificial animals that could be eaten. Couldn't sacrifice them, but you could eat them. There were some unclean animals that you couldn't sacrifice, nor could you eat them at all. Unclean animals were said to be an abomination. So animals could be unclean. Second thing that could be unclean were people. Priests were considered holy. Ordinary Israelites were called clean. Non-Israelites were called unclean. Some Israelites were called an abomination. I guess they were really unclean. So animals, people could be clean or unclean, and places could be clean or unclean. The tabernacle, for example, is holy, clean. The land is clean, the land of Israel. But the rest of the world is unclean. So you see that distinction between God's people and God's tabernacle from other places in the world, from the Gentile world. The food laws naturally separated Jews from the Gentile world. Speaking of that, the food laws were said to be a practical means of maintaining Israel as a holy people. Leviticus 20:25-26. You are therefore to make a distinction between the clean animal and the unclean. Verse 26. Thus you are to be holy, for I the Lord am holy, and I have set you apart from the peoples, from the Gentiles. You're different than the Gentiles, and the Levitical law did that. I mean, even today, the Muslims are like this too, and the Jews. If you ask a Chinese person what identifies a Muslim or a Jew, they don't eat pork. In China, it was Muslims don't eat pork and don't drink wine. I had lots of experience with that. They tell you that all the time. They didn't know anything else about Islam, but they knew that. All right, so to separate the Israelites from the Gentiles is the seventh reason for the clean-unclean distinction. Here's the eighth reason: to teach the holiness of God and the guilt of man. And ladies and gentlemen, I believe this is the main purpose of the book of Leviticus. The laws of clean and unclean are bracketed with two incidents emphasizing holiness. At the very beginning, we see the story of Nadab and Abihu, who were struck dead for offering strange fire. That's in Leviticus 10. And we read in verse 3 of that chapter, "Then Moses said to Aaron, 'It is what the Lord spoke, saying, By those who come near me, I will be treated as holy, and before all the people I will be honored.' So Aaron therefore kept silent." He kept silent about his son, his oldest two sons, being toasted by the Lord, struck dead, because he knew they had come near to God, not being clean. So clean and unclean is illustrated very well at the beginning of, or near the beginning of Exodus, Leviticus 10. In the middle of Leviticus, during the food laws, at the very end of the food laws, we see another example of clean versus unclean, Leviticus 11:44-45. "For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy. And you shall not make yourselves unclean with any of the swarming things that swarm on the earth. For I am the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt to be your God. Thus you shall be holy, for I am holy." And how does God illustrate this holiness in the previous verse? "You shall not eat any swarming things that swarm on the earth, because that will make you unclean." So in the middle of Exodus, we see this distinction between the holiness of God, the separateness of God, and the profaneness of man by the food laws. All right, so we got Nadab and Abihu at the beginning being killed because they weren't holy when they approached the Lord. We see the food laws in the middle of Leviticus keeping us from being holy if the wrong food was eaten. And then at the very end of the book, in the ritual of the Day of Atonement, it's not really the end of the book, it's the end of all the laws, Leviticus 16:1-2, now the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, that's Nadab and Abihu, when they had approached the presence of the Lord and died. The Lord said to Moses, tell your brother Aaron that he shall not enter at any time into the holy place inside the veil, that's the Holy of Holies, before the mercy seat which is on the ark, for he will die, for I will appear in the cloud over the mercy seat. That's talking about the rules for the Day of Atonement. So we got everywhere through the book is this idea of separation from the world, and you don't approach God unless you're holy. The holiness of God and the guiltiness of man, that's the emphasis in the book of Leviticus, and I think that trumps all the other seven reasons I gave why things are clean or unclean. Now, not only is God said to be holy in these incidents I just gave you, but also in other places we can see that man is shown to be not holy or unclean. Leviticus 15:31, thus you shall keep the sons of Israel separated from their uncleanness, so they will not die in their uncleanness by their defiling my tabernacle that is among them. And by the way, we need to make a distinction between moral uncleanness and Levitical uncleanness. Levitical uncleanness is just ritual uncleanness. It means you can't sacrifice an animal in the temple. It doesn't mean that you're an evil person. If a woman menstruates and she can't eat a peace offering in the courtyard, in the temple courtyard, that doesn't mean she's immoral. She just menstruated. If somebody sees a dead deer by the side of the road and moves it out of the way, well, he's unclean. That doesn't mean he's immoral. He just means he can't sacrifice. We need to make that distinction. Now, having said that, this ceremonial phrase, this Levitical phrase, unclean, is also often linked to moral uncleanness in Scripture. There are many, many examples of this. I'm going to give you two. Isaiah 6:5, then I said, woe is me, for I am ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips. Now, that's talking about, and I live among a people of unclean lips. That's talking about people who are saying immoral things. Ezekiel 36:17, son of man, when the house of Israel was living in their own land, they defiled it by their ways and their deeds. Their way before me was like the uncleanness of a woman in her impurity. Well, like I say, there's nothing wrong with a menstruation. You don't think a woman is immoral because she's menstruating, but that ritual uncleanness of menstruation is compared to moral defilement, immoral activities in Exodus 36:17. But anyway, we need to keep that idea distinct in our mind. So let's summarize it even more. What's the key word for the book of Leviticus? NIV Study Bible gives it to us. It's holiness. Now the first seven chapters of the book of Leviticus are about the five main offerings. The burnt offering, the peace offering, the sin offering, the trespass or the guilt offering. And then of course we've got grain offerings, which is sort of subordinate. And we've also got drink offerings, which is subordinate. I said five main offerings. There are really four main offerings, plus the grain offering and the wine offering. So I should restate that. Four main offerings, the burnt offering, the peace offering, the sin offering, and the trespass offering. I'm going to go over all these in great detail as we go through. Now, I've got a summary of all the sacrificial offerings on a table, which I'm not going to go through and which you can't see. But I'm going to refer to it if I have to. And in my opinion, if you're going to keep straight all the rules about Leviticus, if you want to be a Jewish priest one day, if that's your goal in life, there's a lot of stuff you got to know. It's really complicated. So we're going to take it one piece at a time and break it down as much as I can. But I do have it summarized in an article, a couple tables here, all of which, by the way, is on the internet. This great table that I got came from www.telus.net, TELUS.net, in case anybody's interested. All right, then, with that elaborate introduction, we now turn to the text itself, Leviticus 1:1. Then the Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, well, the then there is to show us that Moses is continuing from the last chapter in Exodus, which is Exodus chapter 40, the tabernacle had just been erected then, and now because the tabernacle is finished, it's logical to give laws about the sacrifices which were going to be done inside the tabernacle. Although Adam Clark says it's not easy to conjecture why Exodus and Leviticus were divided, well, to me that makes perfect sense, what I just said. The Lord called to Moses from where? From off the mercy seat. The Shekinah glory of God is said to be enthroned above the cherubim, as I've mentioned in a previous audio. In fact, there's lots of verses where it says the Lord is enthroned above the cherubim, above the cherubim, and the cherubim were on the mercy seat. So many people say that the Shekinah glory of God spoke from that glory cloud from inside the Holy of Holies out through the front door to Moses, who was standing at the door. However, I wonder why the Shekinah glory cloud could not be above the tabernacle itself, above the cherubim, enthroned above the cherubim, all right, but even go a little bit higher and go right through the roof of the tabernacle and be right on top of the tabernacle. And the reason I say that is because in Exodus 40, verse 38, we read this, "For the cloud of the Lord was over the tabernacle by day, and there was a fire inside the cloud by night, visible to the entire house of Israel." So it sounds like the cloud of day and the pillar of fire by night, or the cloud that had fire inside of it at night, it's over the tabernacle. That's still above the cherubim. It's just a little bit further above the cherubim. I've never read anybody that said that. That's just my idea, but I just present it to you. The tent of meeting, we've talked about that many, many times in previous audios. Well, it used to be temporary, but now that the tabernacle's built, the tent of meeting is the tabernacle itself. Why is it called that? Because God would meet with Moses when Moses would stand at the doorway of the meeting of the tabernacle, and likewise the people did sometimes too. We'll see that as we go through. We go down to verse 2, Leviticus 1. "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when any man of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of animals from the herd of the flock." That word offering is pretty innocuous in English, but in Hebrew the word is korban. You might have remember that word from the New Testament, Mark 7:11. "But you say, if a man says to his father or his mother, whatever I have that would help you is korban," that is to say, given to God. What Mark is complaining about here, actually Jesus is complaining, is people were supposed to take care of their aged parents, they would take their wealth and dedicate it, or give it to God, and they would say, "This is korban. That means nobody can touch it. It belongs to God now. And ooh, now I don't have anything to take care of my mother and father with. I guess I'll just let them. Won't take care of them." Well, korban in the Hebrew means given to God. Mark himself, the gospel writer Mark, he translates korban as gift. He says that is to say, given to God. He's writing to non-Hebrew audiences, so he translates korban, the Hebrew word for them. Now, the NIV Study Bible says that, as a matter of fact, most of the sacrifices were voluntary gifts, like the burnt offering. You voluntarily gave the animals that were going to be sacrificed. Not all of them, but most of them were, according to the NIV Study Bible. In the ancient Near East, no man could approach a superior without a gift in his hand. And having lived in China and read enough Chinese books in English translation, but I've read enough Chinese literature to know that, by golly, those are some gift-giving people in the East. Their whole culture would fall apart if they didn't give gifts. I remember going down to Macau one time with a student of mine, and she told me to be sure to leave half my suitcase empty. And I didn't know why she said that. And now I know why, because when I came back, she had my suitcase filled up with liquor and presents of all sorts to give to her father, her third cousin once removed, and, you know, gifts, 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 gifts. So, all of these offerings were to be gifts to the Lord. And in fact, the directions that follow are for voluntary free will offerings, as Jameson Fawcett Brown says. So when any man of you brings an offering to the Lord, that's going to be probably a free will offering. Not something that's required, but it's free will. Now, these animals came from the herd of the flock. The herd is cattle and the flock is goats and sheep. We need to remember that because we got a lot of distinguishing to do when we get down to these animals. Now, it's interesting that the animals were very similar to the animals that were used in the original covenant between Abraham and God, Genesis 15:9. So he said, that's God, said to him, "Abraham, bring me a 3-year-old heifer," a heifer is a young virginal calf, "and a 3-year-old female goat," that would be a nanny goat, "and a 3-year-old ram," that's a male sheep, "and a turtle dove and a young pigeon." Well, as we go through the Levitical sacrifices, we're going to see all of that sooner or later. So Leviticus is fleshing out in detail an old command of God. Now, what animals were excluded in these sacrifices? This is some summary here, some getting us ready for the detail. Any animal that fed on other animals, excluded. Ferocious wild animals, excluded. Unclean animals like horses or pigs, excluded. No sacrifice. Birds of prey, like all the turkey buzzards around where I live, no, you don't sacrifice that. And you didn't sacrifice fish either. Adam Clark says that was because you couldn't bring a fish to the tabernacle. It'd be kind of hard. So lots of animals were excluded. Now, the herd animals or cattle, herd or cattle, that's a generic term for the bovine species, all right? That was emblematic of strength. So if you sacrifice that kind of an animal, it's usually a male. That stands for strength. The flock, sheep or the goats, well, the sheep in the flock, or they were emblematic of harmlessness, innocence, and patience, as John Gill says. and the goat was used to represent the bearing of sin. Although I will point out, goats could be used for burnt offerings too, which is not a sin offering. Sin offerings were always goats, though, never another animal, so goats were especially suited for the symbolism of carrying off sin. If you ever had to deal with goats, you'll know why that is. They'll eat anything in sight, or they'll try to, and they'll jump through your fence, and they'll run over and eat everything in your garden. I live out in the country. My next-door neighbor had some goats, and those goats, they were always moaning and groaning about the goats and what they were doing. I've never seen anybody happy with goats. But anyway, goats are for sin offerings. Now, we're going to have to distinguish names of animals in English because it's extremely confusing because you can have a goat that's in a different species, and then the goat can have a different gender, You can have an animal that is in a different species from another animal. You can have within a species, you can have an animal that is of different gender than another animal in that species. And then within a gender of an animal, you can have a young animal and an old animal, a baby or an adult. So the distinctions can get to be pretty complicated. And I'm not a farmer, so sometimes I've had to use a lot of help with the internet to distinguish them all. So here we go. Let's start with the animals of the herd. Well, cattle is divided. First of all, by gender, we're looking at adult cattle now. You got male adult cattle. Well, it depends. Is the male adult cattle, are they uncastrated? Well, then we can call them a bull. If it's castrated, we call it an ox. We call it an ox. And by the way, these conventions sometimes differ by different regions and different countries, but this is the general way that the words are used. Now, I'm only going to emphasize the ones that we're going to use. Uncastrated adult male cattle, that's a bull. We're going to see a lot of bull being sacrificed, a lot of bulls. Female cattle is a cow. You don't see that used often because female cattle weren't sacrificed. Now, we can take that cattle category and divide it up by age. If we have a young male bull, it's a bullock. An old male bull is a bull. A young male bull is a bullock. An adult female bovine animal is a cow. A young female cow is a heifer. Well, bullock and heifer, we'll probably see that again as we go through. And again, it depends on the English translations too, how these words are translated. Now, we move from cows to, that's the herd animal, it's cattle. Now we go to the flock animals, of which there are two types, sheep and goats. The sheep are divided by gender. Let's look at the adult sheep first. A male adult sheep is a ram. A female adult sheep is a ewe. She becomes a dam after she has a baby, but we're not going to worry about that. So male sheep is a ram. Female sheep is a ewe. The generic term is sheep. Generic term for a herd animal is a cattle. Generic term for a flock animal that's a sheep is sheep. Now let's take sheep and divide it by age. If you have an old sheep, it's either a ram, male, or ewe, female. But if you have a young sheep, we can call them a lamb. Now lambs are divided into young female sheep, ewes, and a young male sheep, a ram, lamb. But we're not going to worry about that. We're just going to call a young sheep of either gender a lamb. Now, going to the second flock animal, a goat. We can divide goats by gender. Let's look at the adults first. A male adult goat is a billy goat, sometimes known as a buck. And a female adult goat is called a nanny. We're not going to worry about nanny goats and billy goats. We're just going to say an adult goat is a goat. So let's look at age of goats. An adult goat is a goat. A young goat is a kid. We're not going to worry about kids. We're just going to say goats. All right, so let me go back and pick up the bolded animals that I've got in my notes here. An uncastrated male adult bovine animal is a bull. A young male bull is a bullock. A young female cow is a heifer. 3 years old or less, not having had offspring. A male sheep is a ram. An adult male sheep is a ram. And a young sheep is a lamb, whether male or female. So that ought to help us get through this. We go down to verse 3 in Leviticus. If his offering, that's an offeror's offering, is a burnt offering from the herd, and that would be a cattle, from a herd of cattle, the burnt offering is from the herd, he shall offer it, a male without defect. He shall offer it at the doorway of the tent of meeting that he may be accepted before the Lord. Now, a burnt offering is an offering that is totally consumed except for the skin. That's why it's called a whole burnt offering many times. And it symbolizes complete consecration to God because all of it goes up in smoke to God. So it's a whole burnt offering. Now, here's some further regulations about how the priest should offer the burnt offering, Leviticus 6, 8 through 11. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the law for the burnt offering. The burnt offering itself shall remain on the hearth on the altar all night until the morning. And the fire on the altar is to be kept burning on it. So it takes all night to burn the offering up, so God gets the smell that burnt offering all night long. Verse 10, the priest is to put on his linen robe. I'm in Leviticus 6 now. The priest is to put on his linen robe, and he shall put on his undergarments next to his flesh, and he shall take up the ashes to which the fire reduces the burnt offering on the altar and place them beside the altar. So the next morning he takes what's left, the ashes, and puts them on a place, and it's to the east of the altar. I'll read later. And he takes the ashes off the altar and puts it to the east. The ashes would go down through the bronze grate in the bottom, and they have fire pans and shovels where they can shovel the ashes into a pan and then carry it off to a pile to the east of the altar as you're going toward the front door of the courtyard. Verse 11, then the priest shall take off his garments and put on other garments and carry the ashes outside the camp to a clean place. He doesn't want to be wearing holy garments outside the camp, because that's getting down in, away from God, which is further to unholy areas. Although the place is said to be a clean place, but he takes his holy garments off. Leviticus 8, 18 through 21, we read this. Then he presented the ram of the burnt offering, as the priest, and Aaron and his sons laid their hands on the head of the ram. I'm sorry, the he there is Moses. Then Moses presented the ram of the burnt offering, and Aaron and his sons laid their hands on the head of the ram. This was during the ordination of Aaron and his sons, which was commanded in Exodus. We'll get to that shortly. So there's a laying on of hands. We'll talk about that in a minute, what that symbolizes. Moses slaughters this ram, which is an adult male sheep, slaughtered it and sprinkled the blood around on the altar. When he had cut the ram into its pieces, Moses offered up the head and the pieces and the suet and smoked. The suet is the hard white fat around the kidneys and the loins where the legs join the trunk of the animal. All that's burnt up. Verse 21, after Moses had washed the entrails and the legs with the water, the entrails of the viscera, the guts, and the legs with the water, Moses offered up the whole ram in smoke on the altar. It was a burnt offering for a soothing aroma. It was an offering by fire to the Lord, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Now, I'm going to go into this in a little bit more detail later, but basically we see the whole animal's cut up in pieces so it could burn better, offered completely up to God, and some of it washed with the water. We read in Leviticus 16, verse 24, he shall bathe his body, that's a priest, with water in a holy place, and put it on his clothes, and come forth and offer his burnt offering and the burnt offering of the people, and make atonement for himself and for the people. This is the burnt offerings involved with the Day of Atonement. So let me give you some general characteristics of a burnt offering, or some not general characteristics, but facts about the burnt offering. First of all, the morning and evening sacrifice, which I talked about in Exodus 29, verses 39 through 42, that was a burnt offering, morning and evening. And on the Sabbath day, there was double burnt offerings, morning and evening. Those were all burnt offerings. Extra burnt offerings were offered on feast days. Those were called high Sabbaths. We'll talk about that when we get to Numbers 28 and 29, but there were extra ones then. Now, and this is relevant for this chapter, in just a little bit, we're going to see in this chapter 1 that different animals were required to be sacrificed depending upon the economic status of the offeror. We'll start from the rich and go to the poor. The wealthy Israelites, they offered a bull. Why? Bulls are more expensive than any other kind of animal. The average Israelite offered a sheep or a goat. So the wealthy Israelite offered an animal of the herd, which is a bull. The average Israelite, the middle class Israelite, he offered an animal from the flock, a sheep or a goat. Now, I'm assuming it doesn't matter whether the sheep or goat. I'm assuming that it's adult sheep and adult goats. Age is irrelevant. Well, actually, it doesn't say adult or young, so I guess it doesn't really matter. The only clear mention of age is with pigeon offerings, which we'll get to in a minute in the last part of this chapter. There is a translation issue here, and New American Standard has the wealthy Israelite was to offer a young bull in verse 5, but Holman Christian Study Bible says you only have to offer a bull. Well, out of curiosity, I did a search on the English translations. Here are the translations that have young bull, KJV, Darby, American Standard Version, English Revised Version. Well, they have bullock, which is the same thing as a young bull. The young's literal and the green's literal translation has son of the herd. The NIV, the Amplified, the Lexham, and the New Century translation have young bull. That's a lot of translations that have it as young bull. But the translations that just have bull are the Holman Christian Study Bible, the English Standard Version, the Revised Standard Version, and the New Revised Standard Version. I think what's happened here is the literalist son of the herd, you could say, well, son of the herd, that sounds like a young bull. But, you know, son of the herd could just mean that which belongs to the herd. And maybe that's where you come up with bull. That's my guess. I don't know Hebrew. I'm going to assume that we can't say anything about the age of that bull. We're just going to assume the bull is a bull. We're not going to say whether he's old or young. So we're not going to put an age requirement on it. That's obviously a translation difference. So the age of the sheep or the goat or the bull that the Israelite had to offer didn't matter. The gender, though, did matter. The sheep or the goat had to be a male. Now, we've already talked about the bull had to be a male. No cows now. It had to be a male. For the rich Israelites, the middle-class Israelites had to offer a male sheep or goat. We read that in verse 10 in this chapter. But if his gift for a burnt offering is from the flock, from sheep or goats, he is to present an unblemished male. All right, so age doesn't really matter. The gender does. And the wealth of the offeror matters, too, as to what sacrifice goes on the altar. The NIV Study Bible says the majority of burnt offerings were sheep or goats, so that's why there's more middle class than there are rich. All right, so that's the rich Israelites sacrificed a bull. The middle class Israelites sacrifices a sheep or a goat. How about the poor Israelite? Doves or pigeons, which we'll get to in just a minute. Now, the NIV Study Bible says that all these sacrifices, these burnt offerings, may have been the usual sacrifice of the patriarchs. That might have been the most common kind of the four major types. Another observation that we can make here is that since all of the animals consumed, burnt offering is emblematic of the offeror's total devotion to God. And that's, everybody says that. That goes without saying. Now, when I say the whole animal is consumed, I'm accepting the skin. The skin is not consumed. The priest got that. The officiating priest. And think about that. If it's a bull, that's leather. Ooh, that's nice. Or even sheepskin is nice. Now, all the other sacrifices had this in common. None of them were wholly consumed. There was always something left over of the sacrifice. The burnt offering, Adam Clark says, was most important of the four main sacrifices. Now, I don't know why he says that. I question that. It seems like a sin offering would be very important. Now, let's look at the meaning of burnt offering again. It's often called the whole burnt offering. It comes from the Greek holocaust. Hollow means whole in Greek, and cost means burnt in Greek. Whole burnt, holocaust. And that's, of course, where we get the phrase holocaust from, which means a complete burning up of something. The Septuagint translates the Hebrew word for burnt offering as holocaust, whole burnt offering, as Adam Clark points out. Now let's look at what I said about the offerings need to be male, as Leviticus 1 verse 10 requires. Why? Well, one option might be is that male animals cost more and had a greater value. That's the NIV Study Bible's idea. And I question that a little bit. I would have thought the female would have more value because a female is able to produce more offspring. Of course, you do need the males for stud purposes too, so I guess that argument is not free and clear above water. The NIV Study Bible also suggests that maybe another reason why the offering should be male is because it was thought that males meant more vigor and fertility, kind of like the yin and the yang. Yin is female and yang is male in Chinese, and the yang is supposed to be more vigorous and the yin is more passive and quiet. I don't know why the offering should be male. I suspect both were true. More valuable, more vigorous. And also a male represents the family. A bull is more representative of something. A male is more representative of something. Adam represented the whole human race when he fell. The whole human race didn't fall when Eve fell, as Paul says in Romans chapter 5. The whole human race only fell when Adam fell, because Adam represented the whole human race. So I think that's another reason why male animals were used. Now, these regulations in verse 3 that we've just talked about, these are regulations for bulls, male without defect. The regulations for sheep and goats, flock animals, don't start to verse 10. Well, I can't tell much difference than the regulations for the flock animals, those regulations from the regulations for the herd animals, except that a flock animal had to be killed north of the altar, which is sort of strange. That requirement is not made for bulls, but I assume if it was for sheep and goats, it's probably true for bulls also. They had also had to be killed north of the altar, and it just wasn't mentioned. I'm sure that might be a question of adjudication. The Jewish judges are going to have to figure that one out, reasoning from the text. Now, the bull should have no defect. Why? Well, sacrifices had to be of value to the offeror. It took a perfect sacrifice to atone for sins. That's the second reason. Valuable to the offeror, and you got to have a perfect sacrifice, even as Jesus was a perfect sacrifice for our sins. There was no defect in him. There was no sin in him. And note also, this is an interesting point. In verse 4, we'll see that burnt offerings also atone for sins. This is not a sin offering. We're talking about burnt offerings here, but it says in verse 4, which we'll get to in just a second, he shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering that it may be accepted for him to make atonement on his behalf. It's interesting, is it not? A burnt offering making atonement. Now, there are many scriptures that say that offerings should not have any defect. Here's three of them. Deuteronomy 17:1, you shall not sacrifice to the Lord your God an ox or a sheep which has a blemish or any defect, for that is a detestable thing to the Lord your God. Malachi 1:8, but when you present the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? And when you present the lame and sick, is it not evil? Why not offer it to your governor? Would he be pleased with you? Or would he receive you kindly, says the Lord of hosts? No, your governor's going to think you're using him as a trash dump. You put a diseased animal on the altar, you're treating God like he's a trash dump. Exodus 12:5, your lamb shall be an unblemished male, a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. And that was a Passover lamb, unblemished. The burnt offering was to be offered at the doorway, we read here in verse 3, and that, of course, is where the bronze altar of burnt offering was. It's the doorway to the tabernacle. The outer veil was the door there, was hanging over the doorway. Whenever you see that sacrificed at the doorway, that means where the altar is, because the altar is right in front of the doorway. We go down to Leviticus 1:4. He, that's the offeror, not the priest now, that's the offeror, he shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering that it may be accepted for him to make atonement on his behalf. Now, all offerings, as the NIV Study Bible says, all offerings require that the offeror lay his hand on the animal. Now, well, there are three purposes of this ceremony. First purpose, it transferred all rights that the offeror had to the animal. And since God owns the animal, that means he owns the offeror. You've transferred everything that you, any claim that you have against God, which of course you don't have any, you transfer everything you've got goes to that animal. That animal entirely represents you. Second reason for the laying on of hands, it is an acknowledgement that the offeror deserves to die. I'm identifying with that animal. The animal's about to die. I'm going to die with him. It's also the third reason for laying on of hands is to impute the offeror's sins to the animal. This is an acknowledgement that the offeror needs atonement. He says, I'm a sinner. I need atonement, so I'm transferring my sins. I'm imputing my sins to the animal so that the animal can die. Of course, the nice thing about that is the animal dies and the offeror doesn't. And again, what's the symbolism of Christ? Jesus dies so that we don't. There are other comments about this laying on of hands that expresses identification between the offeror and the animal. Just as the animal died, the offeror is to die. And when that happens, atonement occurs. And there's complete offering and consecration of the offeror as he transfers all of his rights, all of his privileges, all of his himself goes to that animal. That animal is totally consumed on the altar. That means that the offeror is totally offered up to God, totally consecrated to God. Now it says the offeror shall lay his hand on the animal. It doesn't say both hands. It just says one, but some say both hands were laid, because if you lay one, you could say, I lay my hand on the head of the altar of the burnt offering, and then he could lay his other hand on there too, even though it doesn't say so. It doesn't contradict the idea that two hands were laid on the head of the burnt offering. It doesn't really matter. That it may be accepted for him to make atonement on his behalf. Atonement is a complicated word, hilasterion, which is the word that's translated mercy seat, that's over the ark in the Holy of Holies. It has the idea of appeasement of an angry God. It has the idea of reconciliation with this angry God after the appeasement has been made. It has an idea of covering of the sin so that the appeasement and reconciliation can be made. So these three ideas go real well with this word atonement. Appeasement of an angry God, reconciliation of the angry God with the offeror, and the covering of the sins necessary to make that come about. We go now to Leviticus 1, verse 5. He, this is the offeror still. Now, I know it sounds like it might be the priest, but in the NIV Study Bible, John Gill, Adam Clark, and Jameson Fawcett Brown, all four say that the he there is the offeror, shall slay the young bull before the Lord. The NIV Study Bible says that once that blood was shed of the bull, then the priest could do his work. And again, that's NASB, young bull. The Holman Christian Study Bible has bull, so I'm not going to say young bull. We're just going to say bull. And once that blood was shed, the priest could do his work. So after the offeror killed the bull, in later times, Jameson Fawcett Brown say the the slaughtering of the bull was done by the Levites instead of the offeror, which is nice. I guess the Levites would be more skilled and practiced at it. I don't know. These agricultural people might know how to kill bulls very easily. We'll see later there's a verse that Jameson Fawcett Brown quotes showing that the Levites did this eventually, but now it's the offeror is doing it. So the bull, it doesn't say that in this verse, but obviously what happens is the bull is drained into one of those bases that we talked about in Exodus, one of those bowls, and then the offerer gives the blood, the bowl of blood to the priest, and the priest then sprinkles the blood around the altar, I assume on the sides of the altar, north, south, east, and west. Now this blood, of course, is sacred. All blood in the Old Testament ritual is sacred because it stands for life. The life of the offerer is transferred to the animal, and then the animal's blood stands for that life. And you got to keep that separate from all other things in the world because life is sacred. You don't want to pollute it with anything. You got to respect that, treat that blood with respect. Famous verse, Leviticus 17:11, for the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I've given it to you on the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is the blood by reason of the life that makes atonement. Leviticus 17:11. Life is in the blood. This is a verse that we need to quote over and over and over again. Life is in the blood. That's why when Jesus shed his blood on the cross, it was a fulfillment of the shadow of the sacrifices on the altar where the blood was sprinkled on the altar. Jesus' blood was splattered on the cross. Now, of course, that blood is sprinkled around the bronze altar. It doesn't say bronze, but we know that because it says the altar that is at the doorway of the tent of meeting. The doorway is the outer door to the holy place, to the tabernacle that leads into the courtyard as you move from west to east. Now we go to Leviticus 1:6. He shall then skin the burnt offering and cut it into pieces. Well, who is the he that's skinning the animal? The offeror, according to Adam Clark, is who skins it. But it could be the priest. 2 Chronicles 29:34 says this, but the priests were too few so that they were unable to skin all the burnt offerings. Therefore, their brothers the Levites helped them. That's where Jameson Fawcett Brown got the idea that the Levites ended up helping with the skinning of the animal as well as the slaying of the animal, helping the offerors and helping the priest. So the skin was not burnt. It was given to the priest. We read that in Leviticus 7:8. Also, the priest who presents any man's burnt offering, that priest shall have for himself the skin of the burnt offering which he has presented. And, you know, this cow skin, leather, that might be really nice. Could be very valuable. Why did they cut up the pieces of the whole burnt offering on the altar? Well, that's to make it burn easier. Leviticus 1, verses 7 through 9. The sons of Aaron the priest shall put fire on the altar and arrange wood on the fire. Then Aaron's sons, the priest, shall arrange the pieces, the head and the suet, over the wood which is on the fire that is on the altar. Its entrails, however, and its legs he shall wash with water. And the priest shall offer up and smoke all of it on the altar for a burnt offering, an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. All right, we're still talking about the bull here. The sons of Aaron the priest shall put fire on the altar. Where did that fire originally come from? Originally from heaven, as Gill and Clark point out, Leviticus 9:24. Then fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the portions of fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. I assume that's lightning came from the sky. Pow! Scared everybody to death and started frying the animal. Now this fire that the priest put on the altar, it burned continually on the altar. Leviticus 6:12, the fire on the altar shall be up on it. It shall not go out, but the priest shall burn wood on it every morning, and he shall lay out the burnt offering on it. In other words, you had to keep feeding wood to keep the fire going all the time. And, of course, no other fire was allowed except the fire that came from heaven to start with and was continually refreshed every day. Remember Nadab and Abihu offered the strange fire and got themselves executed for their trouble. Now, the wood that was placed on the fire every morning to keep it going, it was an offering of the people. Later, that wood was brought to the temple at appointed times, Nehemiah 10:34. Likewise, we cast lots for the supply of wood among the priests, the Levites, and the people, so that they might bring it to the house of our God, according to our fathers' households, at fixed times annually to burn on the altar of the Lord our God, as it is written in the law. So the priests, the Levites, and the people, everybody brought some wood to the altar so that they would have a full supply to keep that fire going. In verse 8, it says the pieces of the bull were laid out on the altar. Here's how Adam Clark envisions this. First, after its blood was poured out, the bull's blood was poured out and the skin removed, its head was cut off. Then the priest or the offerer opened it up and took out the caul. the omentum, whatever that is, the caul, that whatever that is, that invests the intestines, the stuff that's around the intestines. They took out the intestines with the mesentery, whatever that is, and washed them well, as also the fat. Then they placed the four quarters upon the altar, covered them with the fat, laid the remains of the intestines upon them, and then laid their head above all. This is so disgusting. I couldn't stand to be a priest like this. The sacred fire was then applied, and the whole mass was consumed. This was the Holocaust, or complete burnt offering. Now, the head, it was severed from the rest of the body. It could have been put on top of all the other parts, as Adam Clark just suggests, or it could have been put on the side. I don't know. But why was the head cut off? My speculation is it was to make the offering easier to burn. If you have a head on an animal, it's going to be hard to burn it. Now, the suet, I've mentioned that earlier. That's the fat about the kidneys, and it's the fat about the loins, hard white fat. Now, in verse 9, there's something interesting. With a burnt offering, the entrails of the burnt offering were washed, and the legs were washed. The entrails of the guts, the inside, that stands for cleanliness. And what that symbolizes is that the offeror should be pure and clean internally. And the legs were washed, that means the offeror, who is identified with the animal, the offeror should walk to do holiness. His walk, his life should be holy. Jameson Vossen Brown gives me that symbolism. Now, all of this is a soothing aroma to God. This is a foreshadowing of Christ's sacrifice, Ephesians 5:2. And walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God is a fragrant aroma. This is a metaphor that's also used by Paul, Philippians 4:18. But I have received everything in full and have an abundance. I am amply supplied, having received from Epaphroditus what you have sent, a fragrant aroma. An acceptable sacrifice, well-pleasing to God. And, of course, this is anthropomorphic language. God does not have nostrils. He can't smell like a human does. It just means he was happy with the sacrifices. We go now to Leviticus 1, verses 10 through 13. But if his, the offeror's, offering is from the flock, or of the sheep, or of the goats, for a burnt offering, he shall offer it a male without defect. Now, this is for the middle-class offering. From the flock, not from the herd, and the flock is sheep or goats. He shall slay it, the offeror shall slay it on the side of the altar northward before the Lord. Northward is if you've got your back to the tabernacle, northward would be to your left of the altar of burnt offering. And Aaron's sons, the priest, shall sprinkle his blood around the altar, just like with the bull, for the rich person's sacrifice. He shall then cut it into its pieces with its head and its suet, and the priest shall arrange them on the wood which is on the fire that is on the altar. The entrails, however, and the legs he shall wash with water, just like with the bull. And the priest shall offer all of it and offer it up in smoke on the altar. It is a burnt offering, an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. And as I said, the only different thing about this than the instructions concerning the bull burnt offering is that for the bull burnt offering, there are no directions as to where it's to be sacrificed, but the a sheep and a goat burnt offering is to be sacrificed to the north of the altar. Minor difference there. And as I said, I think the bull would probably be slain in the same spot. I don't see why there'd be any difference. Let's finish up here. Leviticus 1, verses 14 through 17. But if his offering to the Lord is a burnt offering of birds, now we get to the poor people's offerings. Birds, of course, are cheaper than sheep or goats. Then he, the offerer, shall bring his offering from the turtle doves or from young pigeons. The priest shall bring it to the altar and wring off its head and offer it up in smoke on the altar, and his blood is to be drained out on the side of the altar. He shall also take away its crop with its feathers. The crop is that place in his throat where he stored food, kind of like a cow stores food in his cud, and he would either swallow that down later or he would feed his young with it. He shall also take away its crop with its feathers, and cast it besides the altar eastward to the place of the ashes. The ashes were moved from the altar of burnt offering and put to the east of the altar, and then they would take the ashes from the east of the altar and they'd take it to a clean place outside. So there's kind of a two-stage removal process. Then he, this is talking about the priest now, not the offerer, the priest shall tear it by its wings. Now, people disagree on that. It could be that each wing is, there's an incision on each wing because the wing is not totally torn off. Some people say you grab it by the wings and tear the whole birds and split the whole bird down the middle, but you don't sever the bird. Well, whichever it is, I think the reason for that is so that the animal would burn faster being split up like that, but you can't completely tear it apart because it's so small, you'd wreck it. Wouldn't be anything left. And the priest shall offer it up in smoke on the altar on the wood which is on the fire. It is a burnt offering, an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. Now, the poor were generally allowed to sacrifice birds, we see in Leviticus 5:7, but if he cannot afford a lamb, then he shall bring to the Lord his guilt offering. This is for guilt offerings, trespass offerings. For that in which he has sinned, two turtle doves or two young pigeons, one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering. And the famous case in Luke chapter 22, verses 24, and when the days for their purification according to the law of Moses were completed, this is Joseph and Mary, they brought Jesus up to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord, as is written in the law of the Lord. Every firstborn male that opens the womb should be called holy to the Lord, and to offer a sacrifice according to what was said in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons. That's the guilt offering, not the burnt. This is the, well, one was a guilt offering, a trespass offering, and one was a burnt offering. But the point is that Mary and Joseph were so poor, they had to do the poor person's sacrifice. They couldn't do the middle-class person's sacrifice of sheep or goats. Now, why are turtle doves and pigeons chosen for sacrifice by God? Well, they were selected because of their gentle nature and cleanly habits, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest. They also suggest that other fowls were rejected because of their fierce disposition or gross taste. They tasted bad. Can you imagine a turkey buzzard or something being allowed, or a vulture? No, of course not. Now, why was an option given between pigeons and turtle doves? Well, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, if you're looking for a turtle dove and you can't find one, the pigeon's going to be around somewhere. And if you're looking for a pigeon and can't find one, there's going to be a turtle dove somewhere. Maybe the two species didn't get along with each other and ran each other off. I don't know. But at any rate, the poor had a choice. Now, notice that these pigeons had to be young pigeons. Now, here there is a restriction on age here, not with the cows, not with the cattle, not with the sheep and the goats, the flock. But with the birds, there is a restriction, young pigeons. Why? Again, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, is because when pigeons get older, they are rejected by men, but turtle doves are considered good at whatever age. Now, why that is, I don't know. Verse 15, it says, it is to be laid on the altar. It could be the head that's immediately referred to, or it could be the bird. I assume the whole bird is offered on the altar. Gill says these ashes that are put to the east of the altar, he says it's the southeast. I don't know how he says that. I thought I'd just run that by in case I missed something here. I mentioned the two-stage removal of the ashes. First, the ashes removed to the east side of the altar, and then after that, the priest would take his clothes off, his holy clothes, his priestly clothes, and he would take those off, and then he would take the ashes outside the camp to a clean place. This is in Leviticus 6:11. Then he must take off his garments, put on other clothes, and bring the ashes outside the camp to a ceremonially clean place. Now, one last comment about the crop and his feathers in verse 16. The NIV has the crop and its contents. The meaning of Hebrew for the word feathers there is uncertain, so it's the crop and its contents or the crop and its feathers. Doesn't matter. Ladies and gentlemen, we are finally finished with Leviticus chapter 1. I hope you got something out of this difficult chapter. I hope you'll stick with me as we go to chapter 2 as we look at the grain offering, which is an accessory offering, I call it, because it's offered in connection with the other four offerings a lot of times. Hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.